This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. So we want to jump right into the conversation very quickly with our guest today. But before we do that, I thought we could remind our listeners of about a special event that's coming up in March.
Yeah, we have the Apologetics Canada Conference that's coming on March 1st and 2nd. We would love to see you out. This is our 9th annual conference.
Wow.
Which is just incredible to think. We've been doing this for, 9 years.
Yeah.
And, this thing sells out each year. We would encourage you to pick up your tickets quickly. And, with Christmas fast approaching, it'd be a great Christmas present to somebody who would love to think more deeply on significant topics such as religious freedom. We're going to be addressing that subject on our Friday night with a panel that is going to be incredible. We got Rachel Harder, an MP from Lethbridge, Shadow Minister for Women's Issues, or I can never remember what that is.
Yeah, I don't remember at this time either.
We also have Andrew Bennett and Andre Schutten that'll be there as well. We're going to be basically addressing religious freedom from the perspective of politics, law, and philosophy and theology. So we'd love to have you out. It's going to be a great time. Check us out online for the full conference details.
Awesome. We have one other very special announcement from Apologetics Canada that we want our listeners to know about. That on this day 40 years ago, let me repeat, 40 years ago, Andy Steiger was born.
That's right. Mama Steiger, Judy, gave birth to this beautiful baby boy.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thanks, man. It'd be a real shame if that didn't get on the podcast.
Absolutely. I've been waiting for this all week. Yeah, so this podcast is going to come out in a couple days, a day or two, but you can still send him a belated message of a happy birthday. I'm sure he'd appreciate being reminded of that he's 4-0. Let me repeat that again, 4-0.
You're just being nasty.
All right. So Andy and I have really enjoyed these conversations with our guests and engaging with the questions of Genesis and the historical Adam. So we've decided to extend this series another week. And now it has become a 4-part series. So again, the purpose of this series has been to survey for our listeners a number of different perspectives from the Christian faith. We have not advocated one or another, but have allowed those that have come on the podcast to represent their position. For our fourth view of the Genesis of historical Adam, we have Dr. C. John Collins with us on the line. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Collins.
Thanks very much for having me, and happy birthday, Andy.
All right. They'll keep on coming, I'm sure. So Dr. Collins' background also includes advanced studies in linguistics and biblical languages and has practiced experience in Bible study and discipleship ministry. He has written extensively on biblical languages and interpretation and on science and the Christian faith. Dr. Collins has received grants from the John Templeton Foundation and from the Center of Science and Culture for his work in science and faith. He is the author of Did Adam and Eve Really Exist? And that's a book that we're going to interact with today. And he was a contributor to the Four Views on the Historical Adam. Professor Collins also served as Old Testament Chair on the Translation Committee for the English Standard Version of the Bible and the Old Testament Editor for the ESV Study Bible. Dr. Collins has a bachelor's degree from MIT and a master's degree in computer science and systems engineer, also from MIT. He has a master's of divinity from Faith Evangelical Lutheran Seminary in Tacoma, Washington, close to us, and a PhD from the School of Archaeology and Oriental Studies at the University of Liverpool in England. Since 1993, Dr. Collins has taught at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. Apart from all this academic work that you've done, Dr. Collins, what are some, maybe some hobbies on the side that you do, and maybe just a little bit about your family as well?
Well, I've been married since 1979, and my wife and I have two kids. Two of them, they're both grown and out of the house, and we enjoy things like gardening. We also enjoy things like literature. My wife is very much into Jane Austen stories, and me, I go for things like The Lord of the Rings and the Winnie the Pooh stories.
Nice.
Now, clearly you like languages, and when we were testing our recording, I heard some sort of language. What was that?
That was Japanese.
Wow.
Okay. But how many languages do you know?
I don't know the answer to that. It sort of depends on what you mean by know a language. I know little bits and pieces of a fair number. I would be uncomfortable giving you a solid answer.
That's still impressive, yes. Okay, well, last week we had John Mark Reynolds on, and he spoke to the young Earth creation position. So in the book, Four Views on the Historical Adam, you write from an old Earth perspective. Can you explain for us what an old Earth position is, and maybe lay out some similarities and some differences with the young Earth perspective?
Sure. I tried to make it clear to the editors of the book that old Earth for me means that the age of the Earth is a matter of theological indifference. As a reader of Genesis, I just don't think that the book is concerned with how long ago these things happened. But as an old Earth creationist, I certainly believe that God did make the world, and that the things, the life forms that we see now are the result of God's activity. But God's activity is both in terms of sustaining the things that he made. So I can say that God made my children, but there are also extra things that God can have added. And then people who are old Earth creationists will disagree amongst themselves over how many instances of God adding things to the mix there are. So, for example, in the origin of human beings, the human mind is not fully understandable as simply a mechanism of the brain. There is something in addition to your physical properties that make up your human mind, your ability to know truth, your ability to make good or bad moral decisions, your ability to appreciate beauty. And as a matter of fact, your ability to use language to talk about these things. So human beings would be a clear instance of something that is more than simply a development of the stuff that God made and let run according to their properties. So a young Earth creationist would want to say Genesis does give us at least boundaries to a timeline. And so a young Earth creationist would think that, say, the story told by cosmology, which has the Big Bang taking place somewhere between 12 and 14 billion years ago, a young Earth creationist would think that the Bible doesn't allow that. And an old Earth creationist would say, I don't really think that that's an issue that the Bible addresses. A young Earth creationist would say that what the geologists tell us about the age of the rocks and so forth, that's incorrect. An old Earth creationist would say, well, it might be right and it might be wrong, but again, it's not a matter of theological concern. The main theological concern is to honor God by doing our job well, so I try to tell the truth if I'm a geologist, so that the old Earth creationist is willing to listen to the geologist give his best guess as to how old these things are.
Well, let's continue in that and just kind of jump right into things with regards to how Adam and Eve then sit within that perspective of an old universe. Right. How do you personally understand that working from this perspective of an old universe and life coming to be on this planet and ultimately culminating to a human being?
Sure. Well, so Christians have always, and Jews as well, have always acknowledged that what you get from the Bible is an overarching story. The creation of the world as a good place for human beings to live, and then you have the fall of our first parents, and then you have God's efforts at redemption and various stages along the way. And Christians have always affirmed that that story is not just a nice story, but there's also real events involved in that. So the creation is a real event. The fall is a real event. The exodus from Egypt is a real event, and so forth. So it's important then to affirm the reality of those events. Exactly what they would look like or would have looked like had you been there to see them, there's room for discussion, especially the further back you go. When you get to the Gospels and they talk about the resurrection of Jesus and the empty tomb and so on, I mean, there's not a whole lot of room for discussion as to what exactly that means. But as you go further back, there you get a lot more room for exactly what that means. So what you have to do as a faith affirmation is to set the boundaries. So, for example, that humans are different from every other animal is, I mean, it's a matter of common observation, and it's also a theological affirmation because that difference is the image of God. You know, everybody in the world knows that we're different from every other animal. So, I mean, everybody except, you know, certain kinds of secular scientists, I suppose. But so that I don't really think that needs to be proven. And so the question becomes, how did we become different? The simplest explanation is that you have God adding to whatever material processes produced us to give us the human mind and the image of God.
If I could just pause there for a moment. So then would you embrace then a evolutionary mechanism in the creation of humanity that would just be driven by God?
Certainly. Well, most Christians throughout history and Jews as well have envisioned God going directly from loose soil on the top of the ground and molding that like clay to produce the bodies of the first human beings. So most people have thought that way. And it wasn't until the 19th century when people began wondering whether there's a process of ancestry. And some very conservative Christians and Jews recognized that the language of Genesis, that God formed man using dust from the ground, that allows for the possibility of, you know, something more involved than simply going directly from dirt to humankind. Because, as Psalm 103 acknowledges, all of us are formed from dust, using words just like those in Genesis 2:7. And, well, since you have a birthday, you recognize that there are biological processes that intervene between you and the dust. So I'm not saying as a matter of theological affirmation that there was such a process, or I guess you say process in Canada, but whether or not there was is of less interest to me than what kind of process it is. That is to say, if you say it's just a natural process and God can't add anything, then I think you run into trouble.
You know, I heard you use the word boundary a couple times now, and there's an interesting use that's, you know, really taken from science, this idea of setting boundary conditions.
Yes.
Would you say then that God is setting the boundary conditions?
Well, what I would say is that, you know, it's a mixture of our theology and our experience of the world that enables us to recognize that certain things are just not even worth considering. So if someone were to tell me that when I use language, I'm really just making noise in the air, that's a view that's not even worth considering because you have to be speaking about things in order to tell me that I'm not speaking about things. So it's just so self-contradictory, it's not really worth going anywhere with it. And as I said, all people everywhere have always recognized that when we use language, we're doing something different, say, from the mooing of the herd or the buzzing of the bees, because we're talking about right and wrong and truth and falsehood and so forth. And so a boundary then for belief is that whatever story we have for the origin of human beings, it had better have room for this distinctiveness of human beings. So any theory that tells me that I'm just like a wolf or just like a dog or just like a worm, any theory like that is really not worth spending too much time with because it's simply contrary to everybody's ordinary experience. And the theological position affirms that ordinary inference from our experience.
Now, something you bring up in the book that I think would be a good point at this juncture to discuss is that the topic of Adam, and there's a lot that, you know, we need to unpack here, but I think maybe an important point to just note here is that this becomes then an important discussion in light of human dignity, especially what you're talking about here with regards to a need for a boundary. Could you just discuss that a bit?
Right. And so all humans everywhere crave a community that is founded on principles of justice and equity and fair dealing, and even of compassion and charity. I mean, that's what everybody craves. And so the way we organize our communities, I mean, we invoke principles. We don't simply look at the community and say, well, that's the way it is. We observe our communities and ask how we can improve them or change them or even revise them radically. So we recognize that there's something outside of the biological processes that's the criterion for a good community. So a human community isn't the same as a wolf pack or a buffalo herd. So that what we say as Christians is that God made humans so that, you know, these principles of goodness and truth and beauty and so forth would be actually visible in the way that we conduct ourselves in relation to one another. So there's the dignity of human beings, and at the same time, we recognize that no human community actually fulfills that yearning, that vision. And so, you know, there's something wrong with human beings, and that's what we mean when we talk about the fall, that there's this yearning and there's this recognition of this disjunction between the yearning and what we actually experience. And it doesn't seem like anything we ever do really overcomes this disjunction. And, you know, so that requires help from God, which is what redemption is, forgiveness of our sins, supernatural help to say no to sin and to say yes to what's right and so forth. That's part of human dignity as well, that we're moral beings. I have a dog whom I love deeply, but our dog trainer has explained to us that the dog isn't a moral being like you are. Rewards and punishments, that's how a dog makes its choices and learns what to do and so forth. It's not really making its choices on the basis of transcendent moral principles like humans are supposed to do. And so part of our dignity is recognizing the distinction between us and the other animals and then treating the other animals in a way that's responsible and appropriate. And I mean, we just go down the line, whatever aspect of life we're talking about, whether it be our sexuality or our social relationships, or the way we work, or the way we speak, or whatever, all of these things are infected by this inclination to do what we know is destructive of a genuinely well-functioning community. And that's what sin is.
I think it's in the Four Views on the Historical Adam book that you discuss three factors that lead people to doubt that there was an Adam and Eve. One right. of them is that Genesis is just mythical. Another right. one, you say that the advances in biology, and also that it is impossible that you and I could be affected at our deepest level. Like you're talking about the fall and the sin. Could you expound on those three topics?
Sure. Right. Well, and I think most people in the modern Western world have a real difficulty with the idea that something our ancestors did has a bearing on us. And, you know, that was then, this is now, is what people typically say. And the idea that, therefore, our distant ancestors could have brought us all into sin by their disobedience just doesn't register for people. That's one aspect. And, I mean, there are answers to that, but that's one aspect that plays with people so that they just don't even care whether there is such a pair as Adam and Eve. Then, with the sciences, especially evolutionary biology, the dominant idea is that we are a development of pre-existing animals, which develop from animals that pre-existed them and so forth. If you follow that without, I think, adequate critique, you won't really see a beginning of humankind, because in evolutionary biology, the beginning of a species isn't a meaningful concept anyway. And then the third is in academic studies of Genesis, people have recognized that other peoples from the ancient world also have creation stories. It looks like Genesis has a relationship to those stories. And then the argument goes, well, we don't care about those stories as having any truth. Why should we treat Genesis any differently? And so with each three of these, I think that answers need to be given. But those are why we have the modern discussion as to whether there is such a pair as Adam and Eve.
On that note, let's go just a little deeper in that, because I know one critique I hear from people is that in Hebrew, the name for Adam is just the name for man. Now,
right.
How do you wrestle through that? I mean, is that a proper name? Is it just referring to mankind? How do you tease that out?
The name Adam or Adam in Hebrew is used in both ways in the first couple of chapters of Genesis. It's used as a proper name, like Adam, and then you also find it as the Adam. The Adam, which would be the human being. And so it's, you know, from the perspective of Genesis, it's important that he have that name because he's acting in some representative fashion for all of humankind. That is to say, you know, the Genesis is there to explain why humankind has this problem with sin at the same time as we have these yearnings for these properly functioning communities and a yearning for a proper relationship with God. And so you can have this element of, call it symbolism if you like, that is that the person we're talking about is representing all of humankind. Nevertheless, the word is used as a proper name, and so when you get to a line of descent, like in Genesis chapter 5, you have this guy named Adam, who is a father to a guy named Seth, who's a father to another guy, and so forth, so that this particular person who represents all humankind is also a particular person, is presented that way in Genesis anyway.
Now, how do you work out in your own thinking Adam and Eve as the start of humankind? Would
right.
you see that as that all of humankind came from Adam and Eve, or some will say, well, Adam and Eve are distinct, or a boundary is put there through being made in the image of God? And in light
right.
of that, a question that's often raised is, well, where did other people come from? Because as you're reading Genesis, it sure seems like there's other people out there that in whom they're marrying and whatnot. How do you work mm-hmm. that out?
Right. Again, the usual perspective of Jews and Christians has been that Adam and Eve are the physical ancestors of us all. That's fine, but what you have to do is, okay, where's the boundary? So you could have Adam and Eve as the ancestors of us all. In evolutionary biology, we're told that that's not possible just because of the genetic diversity in the current human population. Now, people have said that, but there's been pushback on that, and so that's really a scientific question that's going to go back and forth. Some have argued, yeah, well, you can actually get an originating pair if you go back far enough and so on. So my own view is that the science should be allowed to play itself out and just do what it does. But whatever we come up with, we should, whether we think there's an original human pair made directly from the dust or perhaps an original human pair that are, as it were, modified from pre-existing hominids, or perhaps even an original human community that are modified from pre-existing hominids. I mean, whatever we come up with, we should acknowledge that something has to happen to transform the dust or the hominid into something that is the image of God. Once that's happened, once you have human beings, you have them made in a fashion where they're morally good, but then somehow corruption comes in.
I just want to ask on a personal level,
sure.
Dr. Collins, maybe a listener is a scientist, right? Or they're doing science, they're doing their investigations. Even for yourself in your own studies, how does your faith remain intact, you know, and strong
sure.
in the midst of allowing the sciences to kind of work their way out? And in some ways, it kind of feels like you're trying to put your faith to match whatever's happening in science at any given moment.
Right.
How do you work that out?
Yeah. The function of our faith, there's several functions. One is that it preserves our good sense. So that, I mean, our faith includes this affirmation of the distinction between human beings and every other animal. And so, you know, we recognize that if our scientific theory is leading us to another conclusion, there's something wrong with our scientific theory. And so certain versions of evolutionary biology are like that, and we have to reject them because they do not account for, not simply for our theological position, but also for our ordinary experience. So that's one function, but we recognize the dignity of human beings and so forth, so there are certain things that we actually refuse to do, even if we're curious about them. Governments make rules about, say, experiments on human beings and so forth, and they should do that. And we don't want people to feel free to do whatever they want to their fellow human beings. And experiments have been done, like with venereal diseases and so forth, are morally hideous. And so that our faith actually then provides guidance as to what's a legitimate area of exploration and what's not. But then further, our faith enables us, it gives us a name for the wonder that we feel. I mean, most people in the sciences do what they do because they think that what they're studying is really neat, really cool, really interesting. And what our faith tells them is that you are absolutely right. It is interesting. It is really cool. And the wonder that you feel is a legitimate experience. My dog doesn't feel wonder in that way, and a chimpanzee doesn't feel wonder in that way, but a human being does, and that's a good thing. Human beings were made to explore the world that God made, and in our exploration, we're not going to find reasons for disbelieving in God. What we're going to find are reasons to be amazed at the God who's so creative that he's made all these intricate systems and so forth. So I think faith and science should go very well together. When you get to some of these intellectual discussions and so forth, it becomes a difficult question, and I think I detected that, you know, which one of them is in the driver's seat? And I don't know that that's actually a meaningful question, or at least you have to be asking, okay, so what did my faith lead me to expect, and was my faith correct in leading me to expect that? There's no simple answer to that question. I think nothing that's really going to work anyway.
From what I hear you saying then is that they're intertwined.
I think they are. In the Middle Ages, people were sure that their faith led them to expect a certain model of the solar system with the Earth at the center. We now think that they were mistaken. I mean, I agree that they were mistaken. And what I would say is they read the Bible incorrectly. It's not that the Bible was wrong, but it was their interpretation of the Bible that was mistaken.
I want to turn to your book. And on page 16, you talk about four possible ways of talking about the material in Genesis. I'm not going to read all four. The people can go out and buy your book and look at the other three, but you say that your position is number two, and it states this. The author was talking about what he thought were actual events, using rhetorical and literary techniques to shape the reader's attitudes towards those events. So I wanted to talk about those three issues there, the actual events, the rhetorical and literary techniques. So can you explain those and maybe give us some examples within your understanding? Like, the beginning of Genesis, I guess, 1 to 4, somewhere in there.
Sure. For some people, and this will be true, especially of biblical literalists, for things to be historical, that means that the only way you can talk about them is with straight description. So people assume that, you know, in Genesis, if it says a day, that's how long it was, and so forth. But in the Bible, we talk about God's hand, God's eyes and ears, and so forth, and we're talking about something that's really there, but we recognize that we have to use symbolism to talk about those aspects of God's character. We talk about things like God's jealousy, and then we have to say, yeah, but God is jealous, but not like in a human couple, where jealousy can be irrational. And so if we need to get more specific, we have to qualify these things and so forth. But so the thing is that in talking about God, we're comfortable in recognizing that we have to use metaphor and symbol and picture in order to say anything worth saying. Science has to use pictures as well. When you're introducing students to the atom and the electrons orbiting around the atom, you might use, say, a planetary model for the atom. And at some stage of description, that's fine. You know, a modern physicist would snarl if you told him that's how you picture the atom, because he'd explain that, you know, these probability functions and so forth, that the planetary model just doesn't capture. But you can use pictures to convey things.
It's interesting, isn't it, with picture and metaphor, that often we're seeking to convey something that isn't lesser than, but actually greater than we can comprehend.
Right. And what happens is people will add a word like merely symbolic or merely pictorial. And it's that qualifier, the merely or only, that that's the problem. For example, I was asked to give a talk at a conference. Actually, it was a conference on reading Genesis, and the view that I was advocating was very different from the view held by most of the people organizing the conference and speaking there as well. So I went into this controversial situation and gave my paper and answered questions and so forth. And when I came home, my children asked me, my children were both under 10 at the time, they asked me, what was it like? And so I said to them, well, there were thousands of them, and they just kept coming, and I kept swinging. And every time I'd knock one down, five more would step up to take his place. But I just kept swinging and kept knocking them down. And when it was over, there I was still standing, and they were lying at my feet in heaps. Now, that's a colorful way of describing the questions and the answers, and my children were not misled by that into supposing that I'd actually shed any blood. they understood, they got the force of the pictorial language, and they envisioned it from the perspective of combat, which, you know, that's often the way theological conversations are anyway. You know, they're more like a blood sport than, you know, than even professional football. So, it's not an illegitimate image, but you can describe an event using a pictorial description, and the pictures you choose will shape the way that your audience will feel about the things you're talking about. So, like in a scientific description, everything's in the passive voice. 5 milliliters of this fluid were added to this test tube. Then a certain amount of heat was applied, and so forth. And you never get the idea that anybody actually did anything. And so the passive voice is specifically to put the researcher out of the picture entirely, and just to think about the things that are being described as if there's no personality involved at all. And so the way you describe it then, as I say, shapes the way that you're helping people to think about the things that you're talking about.
It is interesting, isn't it, how much of the Bible is written from the perspective of a story, a narrative, very relational.
Mm-hmm. You know, the theologizing in the Bible is done in terms of the story. You know, in the Old Testament, we are the people whom God brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. He brought us through the Red Sea. He gave us the land, and he endured with the disbelief of our ancestors. He disciplined us and so forth. I mean, it's just the recounting of all these events that has led us up to the present moment. And so, I mean, we do want to talk about who are the characters, what's God like, and what does he expect of human beings and so forth. But we learn about the characters as they play their role in this unfolding story.
So if we go on to chapter 3, it's called Particular Texts That Speak of Adam and Eve. You make a case for the literal Adam and Eve there throughout the whole Bible, like the Old Testament, the New Testament, and talk about Jesus himself that assumes their existence. But in that chapter, I found it very interesting that you included Second Temple Jewish literature to support their existence. Mm-hmm. And so we'd call that extra biblical support. You mentioned the Apocrypha, which would be part of that, and the writings of Josephus. Can you just comment on that and why you would include that?
Well, it's always good to ask ourselves how somebody else up closer to the culture saw these things. Now, we may decide that we disagree with that person, but we really ought to, as it were, check our work against what they've seen, because it's just possible that they're right and we're wrong. And some of my colleagues in Old Testament studies, they just sort of wave their hands at what the Second Temple writings will say. But I think they're mistaken to do so. They're supposing that we can know that culture better than people who lived in the culture. I mean, that just seems odd to me. There's no point in eliminating relevant bits of data. We have to evaluate it, but we have to consider it. So, again, the fact that Josephus says something doesn't make it, that doesn't settle every question, but it also helps me to see where the burden of proof is. Is the burden of proof on those who agree or disagree with this particular reading of the ancient text? So I think that they do add something to the discussion. For Christians, we take the New Testament as authoritative, but we're trying to understand what is it that the New Testament is saying, and how is the New Testament actually using the Old Testament literature. And one of the ways in which we do that is by seeing how other people in that environment were using the Old Testament literature. And as a matter of fact, it has a distinguished pedigree of doing that. A number of the church fathers actually do that as well, and they're willing to compare Genesis to the stories told by other peoples. And they feel themselves as being in continuity with faithful readers through the ages. To me, that's a virtue, is being in continuity with faithful readers through the ages.
I hope it's clear to our listeners that this book is really well written and thought through. Dr. Collins, I thoroughly enjoyed this book, Did Adam and Eve Really Exist? And one question that I think may be helpful for our listeners just to know as we encourage them to get this book and to read it is why did you write it? What was it that led you to feel compelled to put this book together?
The actual circumstances were that I was asked to give a paper in a forum of a Christian meeting where a couple of fellows were going to be arguing that Adam and Eve are irrelevant to Christian theology, and they asked me to make the case that Adam and Eve do matter, and I thought that was going to be easy, and as I got into it, I realized, oh, there's actually quite a big discussion going on, and we need to have better and more careful thought as we go through this. And then just after I gave the paper, the severely handicapped, mentally and physically handicapped son of our next-door neighbor died suddenly and unexpectedly, and they involved my family in the grieving process. And there were other mentally handicapped people around who were just trying to process, how do we think about this? And what became clear to me more than it ever had before is that this sense that something's wrong and it shouldn't be this way, that that's a basic human intuition that the Bible affirms. And so I wanted to build on that and build a critically rigorous case for affirming that basic human intuition and to show how the biblical material affirms that and works with it. And our story of a good creation marred by an actual fall into sinfulness that then God is busy redeeming and working through, I mean, that explains our actual experiences. So I actually put a little bit of that right at the end of the book, and my neighbors insisted that we actually use their son's name, not to come up with a pseudonym.
Yeah, I want to go off Andy's talk about your book there. Does Adam and Eve Really Exist? Was written in 2011, I believe. So yes. Since that time, you've continued on in this study, in this topic. Is there anything that you would change or update within your book right now?
I guess yes. In fact, a book of mine has just come out in the last month, published by Zondervan, entitled Reading Genesis Well, Navigating History, Science, Poetry, and Truth in Genesis 1 through 11. And so I've done a lot more with what the process of reading looks like and what qualifies as a good reading.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusions that I come to in the Adam and Eve book, I think, are right, but I want to make the whole process of reading more rigorous. Then I would make it more clear than I guess I did. I thought it was clear, but based on some pushback, it wasn't as clear as I'd like. When I look at what scientifically Adam and Eve might look like, I give a number of models, you know, direct from dirt to human beings, or an upgraded hominid, or an upgraded hominid community, or, you know, various things. I would make it more clear that what I'm doing is looking at a variety of possible scenarios. Not that I'm saying that one or the other is right, but these are scenarios that fit within the general principles that I discover in Genesis, and that other scenarios are also possible depending on your creativity and so on. I don't consider myself the most creative person in the world. So, you know, people with more imagination might come up with other scenarios, and so long as they observe the guidelines, those are fine. The scenario isn't, that's not the test of whether the notion of Adam and Eve is true. The test is, A, are human beings distinct? B, are human beings fallen? C, is our sinfulness proper to our human nature, or is it foreign to our human nature? And then D, did that sinfulness come in, or did God make us that way? You know, so that those are the questions that the Adam and Eve story are designed to address. And good scientific scenarios can't really undo the answers to those questions. And if somebody tries with science to undo the answers to those questions, they're not really, they've left off doing science and they're beginning to do more interpretive philosophical type stuff. So I would try to make it clear that, you know, there's a central core affirmation and then there's possible scenarios that they have their strengths and their weaknesses. So I'm not saying that anyone is the right one, but the truth of our doctrine doesn't rest on finding the right scenario.
Great, thank you. We're going to have to wrap this up. And I got to tell you, I've really enjoyed this conversation with you, Dr. Collins. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. I appreciate the questions you're asking and appreciate your appreciation of my book as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We encourage other people to go out and get it. Is there ways that they can come in contact with you over the web? Do you have different websites that you have?
I do have a page on academia.edu where I post various things that I've written and so forth, and you can also send me messages by way of that page. So academia.edu is a facility that anyone can access, and then you can search on Jack Collins, and you'll find me on there. I think it requires Covenant Seminary or something like that. I mean, but I don't know how many Jack Collinses there are in the world.
Yeah.
And of those, I don't know how many of them are on academia.edu, but I'm the one you're looking for then.
Okay. Well, we'll put these on the show notes as well, so people can reference there. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The AC Podcast is the Ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll come back next week with more things to think about.